from WXXI News. This is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection for this hour is being made in a small space in what appears to be a small green-framed case. What that green frame actually outlines is exactly 1 cubic foot. Photographer David Litschwager had an idea. What would he find if he placed that frame of 1 cubic foot in various places around our world? What picture of diversity and the environment would he find? He answered some of those questions in his 2012 book, A World in 1 Cubic Feet, taking his camera and his cubic foot to Costa Rica, Central Park, and more. This week, he's in Rochester, taking his cubic foot to the Genesee River. The Seneca Park Zoo has been working to reintroduce native species in the river, such as North American river otters and Lake Sturgeon, and they and others have been working to clean up the water quality. As Litschwager has said, the river is not just a muddy, polluted thing. It is a community. And the question that we have is, what is he finding? What are we finding there? It's a mystery that will soon be solved, and we wonder, what if the proponents of cleaning up the river don't like the answers? Or perhaps, what if the river is healthier than anyone had hoped? Let's talk about what we can learn from 1 cubic foot this hour with my guests, including David Litschwager from 1 cubic foot. It's a wonderful concept. He's a photographer who's done work for National Geographic and many others, and it's great to have you in Rochester. Thanks for being here.
Thank you very much.
Also,
a lot of hospitality I've been exposed to, so I'm very grateful.
Well, your work around the world has really opened a lot of eyes, and we're going to be talking about that this hour. Also here is Chris Meyer. He is a zoologist and curator with the Smithsonian Institution, the Natural History Museum. I keep tripping on it, but it's nice to have you.
Thanks, Evan.
Nice to have you here as well. Tom Snyder is the Director of Programming and Conservation Action for the Seneca Park Zoo Society. Nice to see you, Tom.
Nice to see you. Thanks.
And back in studio is Pamela Reed Sanchez, the Executive Director of the Seneca Park Zoo Society. Nice to have you, Pamela.
Thanks, Evan.
David, as a photographer, I haven't seen this kind of concept done anywhere, and I wonder what the origin was. You were saying just before the program began, your first 1 cubic foot was in Central Park about 8 years ago. Is that right?
Mm-hmm. The idea was to, how much life can you find in a small place?
Yep.
And then, what is a small place? And it's like, because the first support for the project came from, it was a magazine piece for National Geographic. And when you hold a magazine kind of in your lap, and I wanted to, the canvas, the place where this thing would be shown, that's about what size it is. The magazine is 10 inches high and it's 7 inches wide. And then when you open it up, it fits in your lap. You can put your arms around the three-dimensional space that has roughly those measurements. And you can render it in a magazine. It's intimate and it's not abstract.
Mm-hmm.
So that was make it as real as possible.
What did you find in Central Park that convinced you to keep doing this, to go around the world with this?
Well, by the time I actually got started, I had a commitment to deliver 5 different locations.
Ah, very good.
So what I learned is that, it sounds kind of less significant. It basically changed the way I look at the world because, I was like, I was worried. It doesn't look like much. And it's like, have I oversold this? Am I not going to find very much life here? And literally every leaf I turned over had more than one creature on it. And, it's a pile of leaf litter. There's like hundreds of leaves there. So these little mites or little spiders or ants the whole thing was actually alive. Every surface had something going on.
And how long did you monitor and take pictures and sort of have that 1 cubic foot active?
In Central Park, we had to kind of do it fast because it was sort of a boom period with a high, there was very little vacancies in hotels. So hotels were like very expensive. And I have a fixed budget. So we were kind of in a hurry, but it was about 2 weeks total, but there was only about 7 days actually in New York City because you can't get a collection permit for vertebrate creatures in Central Park. So we had to just make a list. If we saw a bird pass through the cube, we saw a squirrel foraging in it. A raccoon moved it one night. We know it was a raccoon because it was like, it's the only thing big enough to move it. And there was some other evidence. And the raccoon lived, in a tree right above. So we're pretty sure it was that guy and he did this. So we got those same species in another location.
Okay, because when you're going through this process, you're observing anything that comes into the 1 cubic foot into that space, mm-hmm. and then sort of collecting and photographing. How does it work?
We observe for a period of time, and sometimes it's done sort of remotely or with a camera that's on a self-timer that makes a time lapse. Sometimes we just stand off and look at it with binoculars. Sometimes we rely on, you know, evidence. You know, there's a spider web, so we know we got to find that spider. And then sometimes it's the more resident creatures. But this one in the river here is kind of like when I first worked with Chris in Morea. I was eavesdropping on his barcode of life, Morea biocode project, and the sample size was similar to his sample size, a coral rubble sample. It's a 5-gallon bucket. Mm-hmm. And 1 cubic foot it calculates out to 8.5 gallons. But, you know, you have to take it and you work slow because you don't really want all of it all at once because it's really overwhelming. You know, it changes all the time. It's never the same collection method. It never turns out exactly the way. But like in the Genesee River, it's in motion. So we actually have this I watched this morning and timed it. The water changes completely. It's near the shore. The current's very slow. But about every 2 minutes, you have a whole new half a cube, because the cube is half in water, half in air. So half the cube is like new every 2 minutes.
And ultimately what you end up with, again, it's different in every place that you've gone, but you end up with this beautiful look for your readers and viewers of what has come into that space. And for me, seeing some of the work you've done in the past, I was telling David before the hour began, I'm a big creature guy. When I'm out in nature, I'm noticing the big animals, and then I thought of the little creatures in a pejorative sense, you know, the creepy crawlies and those little things. But so much of what your work has opened my eyes to is that just how much is there and how valuable those every little part of an ecosystem can be, as opposed to viewing as something to step on or get out of the way. Was that part of the goal? I'm curious to know what part of what your mission was then.
I mean, there's a Aldo Leopold saying that, you know, if you appreciate or you depend on the whole, then you have to appreciate all of its parts. Or the first rule of intelligent tinkering is to save all the parts. And so that, you know, those, that kind of reference to the importance of diversity, because the first wildlife photographer, natural history photographer I ever did was of things on the endangered species list. So those, you know, trying to tell somebody, you know, why is a Furbish lousewort important? It's a little plant that lives, you know, on the Allegash River in Maine. And sometimes it's a little difficult. What use is this to human beings? You know, I'd say that everything has its sort of own intrinsic value, but sometimes that's hard to, when it comes up against somebody's ability to make a living or some land use practice or something like that, that can get kind of difficult. But what I've learned over the last many, many years, Chris, what size is most of the diversity in the world? Like
small. you know, most of that diversity is, you know, less than you can pick up with tweezers easily. So that's what's amazing in this process, is it forces us to focus on this vast amount of diversity that is generally underappreciated. But it's been great to work with David, because he helps bring the personalities out of even the smallest creatures that you tend to overlook. So
before I ask about what you've been finding in the Genesee River, I just want to ask a little bit about what NPR focused on, what you found or did not find in a cornfield. And that was concerning to me. Can you tell me a little bit about that?
That was a comparison that was made by, who's, what's the commentator's name that designed that story?
I don't actually even recall. I read the version this
it's
morning.
It was an NPR reporter that had a friend who'd done a biological survey in a cornfield. And they spent 4 days or something like that and some nights in this cornfield. And it was a big industrial cornfield. I mean, we're talking acres and mm-hmm. acres, you know, millions of cubic feet. And they found, I think it was 6 or 7 things.
Then
they compared it to what I'd found in 1 cubic foot. And I thought that was really it's a lovely idea to just like, because I would, you know, I'd sort of, you know, what's the worst place that you can find for diversity? Well, I mean, I figured the parking lot behind my house in San Francisco. I live in a very dense, highly urban environment. But, you know, I went out after that, after seeing that thing, and I've, you know, I found 7 species of plants in a crack.
in the cement in a parking lot.
More than in an entire cornfield. So, amazing. You know, that use of that kind of monoculture is profound, significant. I mean, that is a big deal to reduce that amount of the world to that lack of diversity. I mean, that to me is shocking.
And I don't know, Chris Meyer, do I take, I don't know if it's even meant to be a moral lesson. It's not, I don't know if it's meant to say, you know, large scale industrial farming is bad, but I think it was more just educational, that it allowed me to think of the impact of monoculture. What do you make of it?
Well, it's very impactful to look at all the images and material that David's collected in these more natural environments and think about altered environments. And around D.C., we tried to find places on the National Mall that would be great to do a BioCube because we wanted, you know, an emblematic place. But so many places are cultured, gardens, things like that. It's actually hard to find in many of these places really the corners where you expect to find more diversity. You know, these places that are pristine and beautiful oftentimes hold less diversity than you would expect from just, you know, a corner that's been neglected for a period of time. So it's very impactful to think about. And that's the beauty of using 1 cubic foot, because it's a standardized lens through which we look at environments and communities, and we can see what is the impact and what it gives us a standard unit to think about how ecosystems are represented.
It even made me think about the occasional neighbor that we'll have who decides dandelions are just fine on your lawn. You don't need a perfect lawn with no weeds. And ultimately, somebody in the neighborhood will complain. But I have a lot of sympathy or a lot of affection for that viewpoint that says I'm embracing nature in my yard, and that doesn't mean a monoculture of grass that is perfectly engineered. So the projects have made me think in many ways. Pamela Reed Sanchez from the Seneca Park Zoo Society, when were you first aware of the work of 1 cubic foot? Do you remember?
I do exactly remember the moment. I was at a lecture on monarch migration and the rapid decline in monarch migration, and the speaker, Ernest Williams, referenced David's book and the study that you were just talking about monoculture. And I immediately ordered the book and became enamored with the idea of using 1 cubic foot as a way of introducing our visitors to ecosystems and the biodiversity within ecosystems that we represent at the zoo, and creating a new space at the zoo to do just that, to learn about the biodiversity that we can't show at the zoo because we simply don't have enough space. And when you look at how many thousands of objects are in those small spaces, of course we don't have that room. So I reached out to David and said, we'd really love to use your concept as a framework. And he said, well, let's do it. And why don't I come in this summer and replicate it in the Genesee River? And it was once I picked myself off the ceiling with his generosity of saying that, we said, let's do this and let's find a way to make it work this summer.
Tom, what did you think when you heard that this was actually going to happen here at the Genesee River?
I thought it was great. You know, we, like Pamela said, we are rebuilding a space in the zoo, and while we were planning this out, the One Cubic Foot book just mysteriously always appeared on the desk every time that we were going into this meeting. And we just constantly found ourselves flipping through it, and it just really inspired us. And to know that that David and Chris wanted to come to the Genesee was really important, and I think it's really important for the community. And it, you know, it brings art and science together in a way that probably traditionally zoos haven't done. And that's a very big step for zoos.
And it's been really gratifying as we've reached out to the community. There are, you know, dozens of organizations, nonprofits, corporations that care about that river and about the health of the river. And we created a community advisory council that has 34 partners on it. And they've embraced this. We're working with Cornhill Navigation and Delta's Adopt-A-Stream to create curriculum for classroom use and for, you know, going out on the sand patch and learning about biodiversity using One Cubic Foot as a framework. So there'll be a life long after this 2-week period for One Cubic Foot in the Genesee River.
If you're just joining us, we're talking about One Cubic Foot. It's the concept of David Litschwager, who is a photographer who has taken this concept to many places and in a number of countries, studying what comes into a frame of essentially one cubic foot, photographing, studying, and learning from all of the biodiversity that comes in there. And you're done now with the Genesee River? Is it done? Is that finished? No, not done.
No.
You're smiling.
We're just getting started.
You're just getting started.
It's
okay.
Never done.
We took the first sample tomorrow. I'm sorry. I got distracted because I'm overwhelmed about how much there is to do. We took the first sample yesterday.
Okay.
In the morning. And our species count by 9 o'clock yesterday evening, when we sort of had to stop because of getting a bit bleary-eyed, was 50.
50 species.
50 species. And we got another sample that's waiting for us to look at, because we're collecting the things flowing through at this point. And so we have our work cut out for us for this afternoon into the night, and we'll just keep going.
Chris, what are some of the kinds of species we would expect and some we might not?
Well, that's a good question. I think we're going to see a lot of microinvertebrates, so things that don't have backbones that you might overlook. We'll see snails, worms, leeches, a lot of aquatic insect larvae, I would expect. And I think we'll see a lot of, we'll see some leeches, I'm sure, in these habitats. In fact, we did see some last night.
Yeah.
And, so it'll be interesting. I don't expect to see things like crayfish, I think, in this habitat or things like that like probably a little more colder, more oxygenated water. But it'll be a surprise, actually. I'm anxious to see exactly what comes from when we do the formal extraction of this. We went out today and poked around a little bit around it, and it'll be interesting. It's a very representative sample of the river, and so it'll be somewhat indicative of the health of it.
Are there certain markers that you are looking for that would indicate a healthy river, that things are going well? Are there certain things? Is there a number of species or certain species, anything that stands out?
There are when people do stream ecology, there's a series of mostly insect larvae and other taxa that are indicators of health or not. And that's one of the reasons why I think we're doing this, is we're trying to establish these benchmarks and trying to get a sense of, you know, this is a sample in time and space, and then we can monitor that as it moves forward. So absolutely. And things like caddisfly larvae and
what kind of larvae?
Caddisfly larvae.
Okay.
We have three from yesterday.
Three.
So far. I mean, there were more, but we're at this point we're trying to, you know, if things are, we put everything into a cup with a little eyedropper or tweezers or, you know, pouring it, and then so you get 100 cups out on the top of the table, and then you start putting like with like. You know, and sort of making these groups. And then so from each of those groups, we take the time to photograph one. And I'm slow. So if I, it takes all day, all of yesterday, to photograph, 47, 50, we were, that's what, 48. I think we're up to 48 yesterday, and then there were some birds that we photographed that we knew were in that location before. gets us to 50 species, but we were, you know, photographed 75 specimens altogether so far. So it's not, it takes more than a minute. I mean, I spend.
Sure.
Yeah.
Yeah, I have no doubt about it. And so the work that you are doing with 1 cubic foot in the Genesee River then will continue until when?
Saturday afternoon.
Saturday afternoon. Okay. Is there an expectation? Again, these are the most ignorant questions, but, you know, look, I'm not you guys are doing things that are so far from my field of expertise. Is there a number of species that you would expect to see when it's all said and done? And or that you're hoping for? I mean, it's so reductive, I understand, but I'm curious.
I hope that I'm actually kind of getting better at it. So I would hope that we could exceed New York City and the Finbos, the first two places that I did. It'd be a pretty tall order to outdo Morea, which is the in French Polynesia, it's a coral reef. It's like classic high diversity.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm sure, and it would be, also we're looking a little closer than we ever have before. So that makes the species count go a little higher.
I just would add that many of the other places haven't had the mixed communities. Like here we have water, we have vegetation, we have mud. You know, whenever you find edges to have major habitats, you're going to increase your species counts. And so when we think about using the 1 cubic foot theme to go out and investigate biodiversity or your community or your backyard, if you want to increase the number of things you'll find, it's always good to find a mixture of a little water, a little air, a little plant. You know, there's some indicators that will drive that count up higher, certainly.
Well, let me ask Pamela and Tom then, since this is your backyard, what are you hoping to see? I mean, Pamela, you've described this in many ways as getting a chance to start solving a bit of a mystery, which is, you know, the state of the river, and over the years some cynicism about it being, you know, brown, muddy, whatever, and understanding where are we, how healthy is it, the comeback, how you end up with an ecosystem in that river that can allow for the repopulation of certain species. So what are you looking for this week? What would be a good week for you?
Well, it's already been an amazing week to see how much life is teeming in that 1 cubic foot. You know, when we started this project, I was thinking, oh, wouldn't it be great if we happened to place it where a sturgeon went through, because we have been working to repopulate with sturgeon since 2003. And that certainly is a major indicator of life returning to the Genesee. They were extinct, you know, 20 years ago, 30 years ago, and 200 years ago, they were teeming. And because of great, you know, transportation use, industrial drainage, agricultural runoff. The river became on the EPA's area of concern list in the 1980s. It's remained on that list. It's not been delisted yet. And if we could contribute to the discussion and the science behind what's really happening in the river with positive bioindicators, if we can get that part of the river delisted, then we'll be able to see more recreational opportunities, used more as an environmental and recreation asset than it is right now.
Have you seen enough so far that has you feeling good or disappointed in any way?
Certainly not disappointed. I'm not an expert on what it will take to delist us, mm-hmm. but I feel really hopeful. And I think that there are lots of reasons this community should be proud of what we've done in the Genesee. It is a river that's coming back to life. You know, we've seen mink down there. We've seen evidence of otters. We've seen osprey and heron. And it's really an undervalued asset in the community. And we would love one of the things that we'd really love to do is have people really embrace the Genesee.
Tom, what are you looking for?
Just what Pamela said. I think you know, I've worked in zoos most of my adult life, and so you kind of focus on animals. And after we started this, you realize that it really is a community event and community program. And while David was here 2 weeks, I think, total, this is really the beginning for us, you know, and the extension of doing it along the whole length of the river, comparing, you know, upstream compared to downstream. I think that there's just a ton of things that we can do with this moving forward.
We talk about the cube actually being sort of partially in the water and partially out, but a couple of different locations total is what you'll do, or how many different spots will you have that cubic foot, David?
A couple of days ago, I thought that let's try to do two, but I haven't managed to be able to move through this one fast enough because there's too much there. So I think we might only end up with one, or maybe we have to put the pedal to the metal and then do a quick one, you know, to check. And since we do record the amount of effort that's put into it, it's not like, you know, if you spend a week on one and spend a day on another, they're not exactly comparable. But if you note that difference, then you can adjust for the difference. So, I mean, the spot that it's in is within public view. It's at the you can see it from the boardwalk that goes at through Turning Point. It's on the east side of the river, down from actually south of Rattlesnake Point, a couple of hundred yards. Is that correct, Tom?
Yep.
Yeah. And you'll need a pair of binoculars to actually see the cube, and it'll be there till Thursday morning early. So tomorrow, see it, or you'll just have to know where it was. But we have a documentation of where it was, so we can show the context. That'll be part of an exhibit and every other use that the zoo wants to carry forward. And then all of the creatures that we found in it. It's going to be a big collection.
So in just a moment, I'd like to get David's answer to Jennifer, who is probably one of your readers or fans, because she says she wants to know if the Genesee is going to be in your next book and what is the most surprising thing you have found in one cubic foot. So we'll get David's answer to Jennifer's question in just a moment. And we're going to talk about some events coming up this week. As much as David is being stretched thin with his time and energy this week, they've got him doing all kinds of things. Thursday night there's an event, next Tuesday as well. We'll find out more about one cubic foot when we come back right here on Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Coming up Wednesday on the next Connections, the Open Door Mission is expanding its reach and we'll learn how they are trying to help women in need in the Rochester area. Then second hour, you might have seen Hillary Clinton's meeting with the Black Lives Matter Boston chapter. We'll review some of what she said and talk to local activists about what they think the movement needs next. That's Wednesday on Connections.
The pangolin looks like a small armored anteater. Primarily found in Africa and Asia, it's now facing extinction.
They are finding crates filled with pangolin scales, you know, entire boats with bags of live or frozen and dead pangolins that are being taken from the wild.
Pangolins in peril, later on All Things Considered from NPR News.
This afternoon at 4 on WXXI.
Welcome back to Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. It is an exciting week for the Seneca Park Zoo, the Seneca Park Zoo Society, and the many people who have been working to try to bring the Genesee River back to a place of a habitat for more species out there, including river otter, sturgeon, and we're seeing some of the progress through this really remarkable project that has come here. It's been around the world, and this project is here, and my guests for the hour are talking about One Cubic Foot, Pamela Reed Sanchez, the Executive Director of the Seneca Park Zoo Society, and the Seneca Park Zoo Society's Director of Programming and Conservation Action, Tom Snyder, Chris Meyer, who's a zoologist and curator at the Smithsonian Institution, and David Litschwager is the creator of the One Cubic Foot concept. He's a photographer whose work has appeared in National Geographic and other publications and launched this idea of taking one cubic foot and seeing what passes through it, taking a look at all parts of our ecosystem in this small scale. And right now, this week, they're working on one cubic foot in the Genesee River. So Jennifer wanted to know if this means Rochester and the Genesee River are in your next book, and what the most surprising thing you found in one cubic foot would be, David.
Next book. Books are it's a lot of work. I've made seven, a few with some collaborators, a few on my own. yeah, I'd love to make another book. And I don't, even if it's not a book specifically about One Kid Bigfoot, it might be about, you know, even, you know, some discussion about, you know, even small places matter, and even look at some places that are smaller than One Kid Bigfoot. I'm not sure. But this is a lovely experiment, you know, a collaboration with the zoo and being able to continue working with Chris in a different, you know, in a different habitat that neither one of us is all that familiar with. So it's like, you know, trying something new. And the most interesting thing, well, there were some creatures that we couldn't figure out what they were.
Where was this?
Here. Yesterday. We're looking at this thing yesterday. And Chris and actually it was Sarah this morning that figured out what it was. It's a colonial rotifer. And it's like, can somebody remind me what a rotifer is? It turns out they're a phylum of their own. I mean, it's like they're a big deal. And then we did a little reading. It's like in freshwater ecology, rotifers at certain times of the year are the predominant member of the plankton. So they're, from an ecological function point of view, a really big deal. And there's very few rotifers in saltwater. So it's like, this is new. Right. This is a big deal, new thing. So that's fun. And I expect we'll learn some half a dozen more of those things today, you know, because it is really a treasure hunt and you find treasure regularly.
Well, David's here and Pamela Reed Sanchez, what is coming up Thursday night? And then tell us a little bit more about what happens going forward. I know next Tuesday, for example. So let's focus first on Thursday. What's coming up Thursday?
Thursday night, David will be lecturing at the Eastman House in the Dryden Theater at 6 o'clock, and tickets are available online for that and at the door. But that'll be a really great time for people to see just a glimpse of what he's found so far, but we'll primarily, I think, focus on past work, but that's up to David. But we're looking forward to that. Next Tuesday, David will have departed, unfortunately, but we're going to be teaching people how to create their own one cubic foot to do in their backyard or wherever they may like. And Tom's going to lead that next week at Open Late Nights on Tuesday.
Next Tuesday.
At the zoo.
At the zoo. Right. What time?
Anytime after 5:30.
5:30. 5:30 to 8:30.
Yeah. So if you want to try sort of set up your own concept of one cubic foot. David, is that interesting to you that there may be people around the world who are trying this concept of one cubic foot and studying the biodiversity?
Chris and I want 1,000. We want other people to live, you know, but we need it with a certain quality of a certain integrity of data. So it's not, there is a little process and we have some materials that we're producing that are trying to share, and the thing of Tom trying to share that, because it is a bit of a process, and somebody may actually figure out a better way to do this, and I want to know about that.
I think for us at the zoo, there are two different things we're talking about when we're talking about replicating it. You know, next summer we do want to replicate this on our own. We won't do the photo documentation in the way that David does it, but we will be very seriously documenting this, everything that goes through, and we hope to work to do the DNA barcoding that we're doing this summer as well. But when we talk to people on site about replicating it, it's a very different thing. It's really about reconnecting with nature and learning to look for the small things and to appreciate the small things and learning to listen, you know, learning to step away and just be quiet with nature for a while.
And getting dirt under the fingernails, you know, getting kids back out in nature, I think is a very deeper meaning behind this.
Well, I want to read a short comment from a listener named Bill, but before I do, just a reminder, if you missed it earlier in the hour, David's work has taken him to many places. In fact, what's the short list that was in the 2012 book? Central Park, Costa Rica,
the Finbos in South Africa, mm-hmm. Morea, French Polynesia. There's just five.
Okay.
Under the Golden Gate Bridge.
That was six. That's not. Yeah. Oh, in the book. Yeah, exactly. There are five in the magazine, six in the book.
He's trying to remember all the different venues here. So So that's some of the work that's been done. And NPR reported on this comparison, this idea of seeing the diversity that David has found in one cubic foot around the world to a cornfield on a large scale. And what was found was close to nothing, not nothing, but not a whole lot. I mean, we're talking about just a handful of things, of species, whereas they usually find dozen. Again, I mean, the Genesee River, they've already found 50. And so Bill writes and said that, that Evan, you're being diplomatic as a host, but I will make a moral judgment. It sounds like his work is an argument against monoculture. So that's Bill's interpretation. And that's a too strong characterization, David, or what do you make of Bill's comment?
I think monoculture is a dangerous thing because it's susceptible to disease and suppresses diversity overall. It's very useful to us. I mean, if you want to be very efficient about growing corn, and maybe it is a good idea. I'm not an agriculture. I don't know about the land management use specifics to corn farming. I mean, maybe it is better to have this sacrifice zone and be really efficient inside of it. I don't know the answer to that question. My project is not an indictment against monoculture. It is trying to show how much life you can find in a small place if you look. And I think that it turns out that it's fascinating and beautiful, and therefore I don't want to step on it. In Central Park, the place where we did the one cubic foot is behind a fence that's been there since 1939 because it was to protect people from... There's a landscaping feature there that has a little waterfall that goes into the pond. If you were to go wandering at night through the park, you don't want to fall over this little cliff. So they put up a fence. They've since found that that's a nice spot for bird migration. So now it's actually a little bird sanctuary. I like that fence because it means that that place doesn't get stepped on. And lots of the rest of Central Park is lawn, which is beautiful, but it's not highly diverse. And then there's this little paved path. And because I know what's on the other side of that fence and I think it's beautiful, I actually like that path. I like staying on the path because I know that by staying on the path that everything else is in better shape. So that's my little moral lesson. That's the extent to which I'm going to preach. I get personal enjoyment about knowing that stuff is there.
Yeah, absolutely. And I also appreciate the fact that you say you don't know. When it comes to, I think food is so complex. We have to feed a lot of people. Sometimes we need scale. I understand the advantage of what is essentially monoculture in corn, for just as one example. And what we don't know are what's the impact on the land and everything that is associated with it in that spot going forward. There are all kinds of probably unintended consequences. So there's a lot that we don't know. I think of a grape grower that I got to know well on Seneca Lake named Sam Argetzinger. Now, Sam was not an Iroquois, but he spoke the language. He lived among the people and got to really appreciate them. And he came back and he said, you know, as a logger and then as a grape grower, why would I want to kill five things to make one thing grow if I don't have to? That was the way he articulated it to me. He said, I'm not telling you I never spray when we have a high disease pressure year, but I'm telling you that if I don't have to kill five things to make one thing grow, I won't. And that's stuck with me, I guess. So I appreciate you saying you don't know, and I appreciate Bill's comment saying it sounds like an argument against monoculture. But you know, those are the things that stick with you, and that's the kind of thing that David's work makes you think about. I mean, Pamela, I'm waxing now. I'm waxing nostalgic kind of. But what does his work make you think of?
Well, you know, I have an art background. I've worked in arts and culture for 20 years before coming to the zoo. And for me, art provides that transformational moment. It gives you that aha moment that makes you see the world differently. and using art to create people or to connect people to the environment is very important to me. And to see that people's face light up when they look through the pages of his book and they say, oh, I get it. I understand this. And look how beautiful that snail is. And look how cute that frog is. And you begin to appreciate those small things. And it's really been gratifying to see people want to take up this project as their own.
What do you think?
Well, I think the first time we talked to David on the phone, we were trying to put the team together for this, and we asked him what kind of people he wanted involved with it, and he was quiet for a few seconds and then said that he was looking for people with an affinity for the small things. And that was the first conversation with him, so we kind of knew right off the bat that things probably weren't going to be quite as, you know, normal as what we were used to. So
it's a new normal.
Yeah. And, you know, so if you think about it that way, the connection that the art brings is really something and very powerful.
I like that connection to the small things idea, because it was just a couple of weeks ago that Pamela was on the program as we talked about Cecil the Lion, and I understand the emotion and the sentiment that has come out of that incident, but that is a big, beautiful creature. And David's work is a reminder that a lot of the little creatures are important, you know, really needed. And whether it's the question of what's happening to bees, which don't get the sentimentality that lions get, but, you know, the question of what is actually happening to bees and bee populations, or other things. I mean, this is such an ignorant question, and I apologize for being the host who has the least background ever on this subject. But Chris Meyer, what are the little things that really matter to a community that we probably take for granted?
Well, usually everything starts out small at some point in their life. So that's but there are a lot of creatures that never make it past a few millimeters in size. And these fundamentally small organisms are usually absolutely critical for food and food webs, and providing the base of the nutrition that fuels the bigger things that we think are more charismatic and representative of communities. I mean, and the work by focusing on the one cubic foot, I mean, the tagline I like to use is you make the ordinary extraordinary. I mean, it's really it just a better appreciation for these little creatures, and thinking about, you know, big things need to eat little things, and the connections. These are functioning communities, and they all are operating in this small space, and they're connected and sharing a neighborhood. And the small things are mostly invertebrates or algae or fungi, and there's a huge diversity. You know, more than half of all the species, you know, are arthropods, very small creatures.
Let me grab a phone call, and I want to revisit a point that Chris was just making, I think, very importantly. But this is Jack, and Jack's calling about one cubic foot in the Finger Lakes. Jack, go ahead.
Yes, thank you. Great program, Evan. You do a great job of connections. I haven't read David's book, but I intend to. My question, or maybe even a suggestion, would be take the cubic foot study into the Finger Lakes, where we have monocultures that are rotated, quite often soybeans and corn. And in part of that cycle, fields are covered with manure. However, when the soybeans and the corn are, after they've gotten a good start, they spray them with Roundup. And I just wonder, you know, we've got all these nutrients going into the soil from the manure and from the plants, but what effect does the Roundup have, other than killing the weeds, on the cubic foot of soil? I would be just curious. If it's not been done, it would be a suggestion for them to compare to the monoculture that you talked about earlier, and I'll take my answer off the phone. Thanks.
Jack, thanks for the call. Interesting points and question. First of all, let me ask the photographer himself. He's thinking about Roundup and the impact on one cubic foot. Have you thought about that before, David?
And Chris mentioned there these landscapes that are highly tended, managed, treated, whatever you want to use for it. they're going to be different. It would be interesting to how, I don't know the toxicity level of certainly completely toxic to certain species of plants. But is Roundup, you know, toxic to the other soil fauna? I would imagine it might be. So the thing is, there's this huge diversity, you know, in the soil, these creatures that live between grains of sand. And then I was in the One Cubic Foot book, E.O. Wilson was kind enough to write the introduction for it. And he talks about this, you know, this world that's even smaller than what I could see, you know, that I could keep and kind of in trying to hopefully inspire me. I mean, I took it personally to like keep looking. I mean, this is great. And he said, we start looking at the big things, then we go to the small things. And then he talks about things in the scale of the one cubic foot frame, what's visible. And then he said, and you can keep going. So that thing, the, you know, orbated mites in the soil, they may be the most numerous animal on the planet, you know, in that scale of, you know, grains of sand, which is slightly smaller than I've ever gone before. And so I've just, you know, I just missed what there is the most of if by limiting that scale. So I think about it. I think it certainly bears consideration, and I would encourage someone to go get themselves a teaspoon of soil from a treated area and an untreated area and tell us what you find. That would be great to know.
It's a great point. And I was listening to Chris just talk about the value of the small things sometimes as food, as part of a food chain. And one thing, just another of the many things about these subjects that I'm ignorant about is the question of extinction and how often extinction is happening on this planet and for the various reasons. Is there a concern that if you came back and did one cubic foot 100, 200 years from now in the same places that you've been, that a lot of those important links in the chains, or at least some, could be gone with unintended consequences that, you know, reach other species and maybe higher up the food chain than we think? Is there a concern about that, Chris?
Well, absolutely, there's a concern. I think, you know, we're seeing the sixth extinction here in what's called, been termed the Anthropocene. You know, we've been having an impact on environments and ecosystems in ways that are geologic in scale in many ways. I have no doubt that if you come back 100 or 200 years to most of any of these spaces, you are going to see different communities because of various effects and climate change and various other aspects. And certainly, you know, one of the beauties of a cubic foot approach is to get to do the documentation, to identify the pieces. We still, you know, more than half the species out there have yet to be described. And so by going out there and doing this kind of work and partnering with people who are excited to be documenting that, we'll provide those benchmarks so that we can monitor change through time.
David, how would you answer the question?
I spent a year researching and doing a magazine article for National Geographic about ocean acidification, which is the sort of other consequence of elevated CO2 besides a temperature increase. And then I made a list. I took all the pictures that I'd taken in the last 10 years, you know, for every different project I work on, and I made a collage of all of the calcifying creatures that would be negatively affected by ocean acidification. And it is a huge number of creatures, collage. And this is just the things that I photographed. So I think that's, the world is going to change radically. And it's going to, climate change, elevated CO2, ocean acidification, you know, they're all they're all connected to CO2. How much fossil fuel we convert to carbon in the air. It is radically changing. And we did this. And what we've let loose, you know, we can't put it back in the bottle tomorrow either. So it's going to be It's what we've done is a very powerful thing. We are very powerful creatures, and we need to realize that there are consequences to our behavior.
And I think that's one of the things that we will be doing with this long-term exhibit at the zoo that we'll prototype next spring, that will be kind of an immersive experience, showing people if you do this in the environment, what's the impact 20 years from now, 50 years from now, whether this is a positive impact or a negative impact. So if you introduce chytrid, for example, into a fungus that's not too common in Madagascar right now, what happens if you introduce it? You'll see the reptiles begin to just disappear. But what happens if you do something positive, you lower CO2 emissions, what's the fauna that comes back to life? So we're trying to teach people through this how to live more sustainably and how an individual's actions taken collectively can make a difference so that 50 years from now, we are living in a more sustainable environment than we are right now. And we can do that right here in the Genesee River.
All right, well, before we lose the entire hour here, and it has slipped by quickly, Pamela Reed Sanchez, Thursday night, what's coming up Thursday?
Thursday night, lecture at the George Eastman House, 6 p.m.
6 p.m. at the George Eastman House. You can get tickets now.
Yes, you can.
And you can meet David, see his work, some of his past work, and maybe even some ideas about what's been happening in the Genesee River. Next Tuesday, starting at 5:30, right?
5:30, gates close at 7:30, but you can stay till 8:30.
At the zoo.
Yep.
And what's going to be going on then?
We'll be talking a little bit about biodiversity, and we will teach you how to create your own one cubic foot.
And then you got a sense from Pamela just a moment ago about going forward, all the different things that will be happening.
There also will be an exhibit at Rochester Contemporary Arts Center in February of the work that Dave is doing in the Genesee.
All right. And Chris, am I missing anything as well?
Well, stop by the zoo this week. We're working there and say hi.
Yeah, David's images are being shown on the big screen at the zoo, so there's definitely worth coming by.
There's a feed from the camera that we're using up onto the big screen.
Oh, very cool as well there. So you can see that there's so much happening at the zoo, in the river, at George Eastman House Thursday night, all of these things happening. Thanks to our panel here who have been here today. David Litschwager, One Cubic Foot. The book is A World in One Cubic Foot. Fascinating stuff. Thank you for taking the time.
Thank you.
Thanks.
And Chris Meyer from the Smithsonian Institution. Thank you, Chris. Nice meeting you.
Thanks, Ed.
And from the Seneca Park Zoo Society, Tom Snyder. Thank you, Tom.
Thanks.
Pamela Reed Sanchez. Thank you, Pamela.
Thank you, Evan.
Our thanks to Val LaBanca, the engineer of this program. I'm Evan Dawson, and we will talk to you Wednesday right here on Connections on member-supported public radio.